This is an interview with Virginia Hanna by Virginia Hanna for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted in the home of Mrs. Hanna at South Portsmouth, Kentucky on August 25, 1978. I believe every thinking person reflects on the forefathers he has known and wonders about those he did not know. My brothers and sister and I were fortunate to have one grandfather who lived in our home many years. We also knew our grandmother, who was the wife of the grandfather who lived with us after our grandmother died. I feel very fortunate now that I'm older that my grandfather Felty and my own mother talked to us about their ancestors, the way they lived, the things they did to make a living, and the things they did for entertainment. My grandfather, Alfred Felty, was born September 25th, 1859. He was the son of Charles and Sarah Floyd Felty. Charles Felty died when Grandpa was very young, and his mother's folks took him and his brother George into their home when the mother remarried. The boys lived until they were grown with the Floyd family. My grandfather married Martha Glenn, who was born February the 2nd, 1868, the daughter of George Washington Glenn and Sarah Phipps Glenn. She was the grandfather of Polly Phipps, and I have forgotten Grandpa Phipps's first name. I'm sure that my grandma Felty had told me that name, but for the life of me, it escapes me right now. Now, Grandpa and Grandma Felty were the parents of Fred Felty. He was born in 1887 and he died in 1951. Now, Uncle Fred had married Annie Richards, and they had four children who are all dead now. My dad was Oscar Felty. He was born May 21st, 1889, and died July 17th, 1966. There were seven of us children. Now, I'll name them just a little later on. Then Dad had four sisters. There was Myrtle, who was born in 1893, and she married George Chambers. Now, Uncle George died, and Aunt Myrtle lives in Sarasota, Florida, just across the street from her only child, Dorothy Sherwood. Dad's sister Gertrude was born in 1895, and she died in 1908. Aunt Kate was born in 1898, and she married Ernest Adkins. He was one-time deputy sheriff of Greenup County, and he was chief of police in Greenup, and they owned a restaurant in Greenup. I believe they had seven children, all of whom are living, and Uncle Ernest and Aunt Kate live in Pickway, Ohio. Then the youngest one in the family was Grace, who was born in 1905, and she married Fred Lewis. They had one daughter and three sons. Now, that daughter married Clyde Van Bibber, who was from Route 7 in Greenup County, and Angela died after they'd been married, probably 5 or 6 years. Then Grace has three boys, all living, and they're married and have children of their own. Now, my dad was Oscar Felty, and as I stated, he was born May 21st, 1889 in Adams County, Ohio. But as a very small baby, he was brought to Greenup County, Kentucky. And he was raised on what is called Dry Fork in Greenup County. the edge of the county that butts up against Lewis County, just across the line from Firebrick, Kentucky. Now, my mother was Malvina Fisher Felty. She had a middle name. It was Malvina Elizabeth Fisher. She was born in Quincy, Kentucky on July the 9th, 1892. She was the daughter of Charles Fisher and Anna Baker Howe Fisher. My grandfather Fisher was said to be a very large man with dark hair, dark eyes, dark complexion. I've been told by people who knew him well that he was the finest maker of saddles who ever came to Kentucky. He was from Wichita, Kansas, and he died in 1893 when my mother was 14 months old. And my grandmother, Anna Fisher, was a public school teacher. Now, I know nothing more about my grandpa Fisher's relatives. My Howe relatives originated in France and in Warwickshire, England. We have a pretty thorough history of them, but my mother talked most of the relatives, beginning with, I believe, John Howe, John W. Howe, who was born in 1752 and died in 1835. He was a private in Captain Cloyd's company. Now, this company was from Virginia, and he was an Indian spy in the Revolutionary War. Then there was a daughter of James and Martha Howe, Mercy, M-E-R-C-I-E, J. Howe. She was born December 3rd, 1805, and died October 2nd, 1840. Then there wasn't much information about those people. There is in a book that's called Listen to the Mockingbird, but the part that my mom handed down to me didn't include too much about them. But she knew most about the relatives, beginning with Major James Howe, who was born in 1774 in Montgomery County, Virginia. Now, he was the son of John and Mary Howe. He was a major in the War of 1812, and he surveyed some of George Washington's land. He married Martha Hood, who was a sister of Andrew Hood, an early pioneer of Greenup County. They lived in Greenupsburg on Town Branch near the Hood family, and later moved to Old Town, where they built a brick home, and that home was said to be the first brick house in what is now Greenup County, Kentucky. Their home was known as Willow Grove. James donated the ground for the old log church, which stood at Old Town many years. James died in 1845 and was buried at Old Town. James and Martha Patsy Hood Howe, Patsy being his pet nickname for his wife, were the parents of 10 children. Their son James Andrew married a widow, Malvina Cameron Craycraft, and they had 6 children. My grandmother, Anna Baker Howe Fisher, being one of this family. Each of the Howe grandmothers I've mentioned was a public school teacher. It seems that's the only work outside the home that a lady could do in those days and be highly respected. My grandfathers, both on my father's side and on my mother's side, were farmers and workers of timber. They all made cross ties and they sawed lumber. These products were hauled to market by team and wagon and sold in Portsmouth, Ohio. Most of the food was raised on the farm and excess was processed for winter use. My mother's folks raised sheep. The women made the family clothing and the bed clothing from the wool taken from the sheep. Some cotton cloth was purchased, but the garments were made by the women in the family. Most clothing was handmade at home, and the ladies of the Howe clan were especially adept with the needle and thread. About twice a year, a shoemaker would come through the area and take orders for shoes to be made for the family. He would then stay with the family until the shoes were made. When the job was completed, he'd move on to the next farm where a job would be waiting. Cornmeal was made from corn grown on the farm. Flour was purchased by the barrel. Other staples that had to be purchased were salt, sugar, coffee, and spices. I mentioned sugar, although much honey was used for sweetening, and this was harvested from the bees grown on the farm. Two kinds of salespeople came through the country where my folks lived. One fella who was known as a huckster, and the other a pack peddler, came through with various wares, and the country people would buy what was needed and what they could afford. I should tell you the difference in hucksters and pack peddlers. The hucksters had horse and wagon, and of course more wares than the pack peddler, since he carried his wares done up in a bundle and thrown over his shoulder. His only transportation was walking. My grandmother Fisher died when my mother was 14 years old, and my mother lived with my grandparents until she completed her schooling that qualified her to go to Greenup and take the common school examination to qualify for a teacher's certificate. She completed the examination and was granted a certificate to teach in the public school of Greenup County. She was hired to teach at the Dry Fork School, where she had 13 students in all 8 grades. I believe she told me her youngest student was 3 years old. Mom didn't mind taking the babies of 3 years because the enrollment was small, and she was happy to have whoever came and to give them whatever help she could. Several of my mother's students are still living. One is Minnie Dunn, who was a Goldson, G-O-L-D-S-O-N. She lives on Schultz now, near Bryson's store. Then also there's Alvis Glenn and Grace Lewis and Kate Adkins, and I expect many others. They still speak very highly of my mother's ability as a teacher and her being their good friend. While my mother was teaching on Dry Fork, she boarded with Alfred and Martha Felty. She told me that one weekend, a very handsome young man appeared at the dinner table. The young man was the Felty's son, Oscar, who had been away at work at his sawmill near the Greenup, Lewis County line on John Will Thompson Hollow. After 6 months of weekend dating, Oscar and Malvina Fisher were married on January the 2nd, 1911. They became the parents of Thelma, who was born October 31st, 1911, and she's an interior decorator. She's married to Shell Lewis and lives in Lincoln Park, Michigan. They have 2 children, Helen Rainey and Raymond Lewis. Belva was born September 8th, 1914, and she was burned to death at the age of 8. I was the 3rd child, Virginia Evelyn Felty, born November 8th, 1915. I married Ernest Hanna, and I became a public school teacher. And I have 2 children, Tommy Hanna, who lives in Crossville, Tennessee, and Ernestine Watts, who lives in Cincinnati, Ohio. Tommy has 3 children, and didn't mention whom he married. Both my children met their mates in college. Tommy married Mary Berger at the University of Cincinnati, and Ernestine married Michael Watts from Cincinnati, but she met him while she was in school at the University of Kentucky. They have one little boy, Michael David Watts. My brothers were Robert, born October 9, 1920. He married Reba Craycraft, and they had four children. Conroy was born July 17, 1922, married Opal Pence, and they had two daughters. Ralph was born September 13, 1924, and he married Irma Hanna. They have three children. Boyd, born December 22, 1931, is married to Justine Fetters. They have two children, and they live in near Charleston, West Virginia, at Winfield. My father was a very hard-working man, and he believed everybody else should work. My parents owned close to 500 acres of land in the Firebrick, Lewis County, Kentucky community. Now, I think Firebrick got its name because there was a brick plant there, and when the brick plant came, because of the abundance of clay and the a sufficient number of people lived there that could supply the labor to run the plant, and the area just got its name from that particular thing. The brick plant's no longer there, and the community has grown. It's more heavily populated, but the farms are smaller because farms have been cut up to give parcels of land to children of the landowner, and when these children get married, you know, and they build a home and raise their family there. Now, my parents raised cattle and hogs. They slaughtered animals for their own meat. Cattle was sold to other farmers, and often some were taken to market, which was commonly called the stock sale day. Also, Dad always kept the brood stock, and people came from all over the area there to use Dad's brood stock, or breeding stock, and that's another way that he had of supplementing his income. Usually the hogs were killed for our own use in November during the first really cold spell. After the animals were thoroughly cooled, they were cut up and the fat trimmed away for lard, which was rendered out of doors in a large iron kettle over a wood fire. When the solids, or cracklings, floated on top of the liquid, the lard was ready to be put in large cans. Then it was stored for a year's use. The lean meat was trimmed away, and this was put through the food chopper or grinder to make sausage. The sausage was seasoned with sage that had been raised on the farm, salt and pepper being the only addition that had not been produced at home. The sausage was stored in large stone jars, 1 gallon size or larger. These jars were set in an outbuilding commonly called a smokehouse. The sausage and lard stayed cool and kept well there. In the event, though, that we did have some warm weather, my parents would bring the sausage in, make sausage cakes or patties, fry them, put them in mason jars and cover with the grease that had cooked out of the sausage. Seal the jars with the proper ring and lid, and then these would be placed in the cellar. All this was necessary to ensure against spoilage and that we would have sausage the year round. Now, we had no refrigerator or home freezers as we are blessed with today. After these jobs were taken care of, then, it was time to smoke the hams, shoulders, and side meat that is now called bacon. The smoking was done in a very special way in the smokehouse with hickory wood cut from the heels of the farm. The ribs, backbone, liver, and other offals, as Daddy called them, were used immediately. We had our own share at home, but the neighbors were always given a good portion to cook for their families. The chickens, guineas, turkeys, and geese that were raised on the farm were the responsibility of my mother, and any profit made from them was hers to do with as she wished. We had plenty of eggs, and did you know a guinea egg is smaller than a hen egg, but so tough it's very difficult to break. The egg of a turkey or a goose is much larger than the hen egg. I remember once when I was attending Morehead State College, I received a package from my mother. She had sent a new pair of shoes with a little note saying, "Step lightly, you're walking in goose eggs." She had sold eggs to buy my shoes. A young goose or gosling will stand in the rain holding the head back with the mouth open and drown himself. But they certainly, if you can get them raised, you get the finest feathers for pillows and feather beds. Now, I don't have a feather bed, but as a child, I slept on a feather bed that my mother made from goose feathers. A turkey is the only fowl or animal that we ever raised that had to be taught to eat. We put marbles, bright pieces of metal or glass in their feed, and the young poults would pick at the bright objects, taste the feed, and thus learn to eat. Much of our land was in timber. Dad always owned a sawmill. He worked on the farm or at the sawmill every day from 7 o'clock in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. At this time, he'd take his lunch pail and go to the lock and dam to work from 4 until 12 as an engineer. He held this job for 35 years. Dad always kept the boys in the fields or at the sawmill if they weren't in school. I believe he did this to teach them to work, to teach them responsibility, and to keep them from getting into trouble. We girls had our jobs, too. Thelma learned to sew, cook, and to help with the other children. We were sent to school early, and we were kept in school regularly. I became an education addict, I guess. Each year I began to go to school in July, and I attended the 7 months they were open. Then I went on to city school, which was Greenup or South Portsmouth, depending on which dam Daddy was working at. I was graduated from South Portsmouth High School on May the 19th, 1932. I went then to Morehead State Teachers College. At that time, a student could earn 32 credits. This was 1 year or two semesters of work. And the State Department of Education would issue a teaching certificate on this credential. And one could teach in public school 3 years. During this time, the teacher could earn 16 credits on presentation of proof of credits earned. The teaching certificate was renewed for another 3 years. This process could be repeated until 132 credits and a degree were earned. This should explain to you how I was able to begin my teaching career when I was only 17 years old. At that time, the rural schools were controlled by three area residents. Usually, these men were business people. They were called trustees. When I received my first teaching certificate, I went first to the superintendent of the Lewis County Schools, Miss Anna L. Bertram. She assured me there was a place for me, but she was against my teaching my first term in my home school. The trustees were agreeable, though, that I should teach there, and they signed my application for the job. I was hired, and school opened July 17, 1933, with Miss Thelma Howard as teacher of grades 1, 2, and 3, and I with grades 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. I do not recall the number of students in the first three grades, but I know I had 52 students in my classroom. Three of these were my brothers, Robert, Conroy, and Ralph. I think I've never worked harder or enjoyed anything more than my first year of teaching. As I reflect on that first year of teaching, I'm sure I must have known less than any teacher who ever went into the classroom, but oh, I worked so hard to try to teach those children, and believe me, they taught me a lot of things too. The next 2 years I taught on Montgomery Creek, where I had 87 students in all 8 grades. One funny little story I recall was Myrtle Bentley, a very small black-haired child, came to school and she looked so frightened and I thought she might cry, so I tried to start a conversation by asking how old she was. She said, "I'm 5, but my ma said you asked me to say 6. Guess she thought I'd send her home. My 4th year, I went to Rose School on Lower Kinnikinick Creek. There, I had only grades 1, 2, 3, and 4. Attendance was poor because the school and one home were on a little space of ground where there was a hill at the back and no houses were there, and the other 3 sides were bounded by a creek. And when it rained, that creek just raged, and nobody could get to school except the one child who lived in the house on the little, I guess we'd have to call it a island, or really not an island, but anyway, that strip of land. Everybody else was cut off from us. And I've spent many, many days in the building with that one child. The next year I was sent to Spy Run on the upper fork of Kinnikinick. Again, I had all 8 grades, but a small enrollment. I suppose something I should mention here is that I reared my own children in the classroom. And on this particular year, when I was at Spy Run, I went back to teach the day before Tommy was 6 weeks old. I had lots of help. My girls loved the little baby, and when he cried, we knew he needed some kind of attention. One of the students would check, and if he were wet, he'd be changed by that student. If he wasn't wet, everybody had a little study session while I fed the baby. No bottles, you know. Now, Ernestine wasn't quite so fortunate. She didn't come to school with me until she reached her first birthday. From that time on, though, she didn't miss any time in the classroom, either with me or in a school where she was formerly enrolled. From there, I went back to Firebrick to teach. I taught several years there. I can't recall just how many years. But then there was a time during those years that Spy Run could not get a teacher for the regular year. So I taught through the summer at Spy Run. Also during this time, I went to Baltimore during World War II and taught a few years while my husband worked in the shipyards there. After we returned from Baltimore, while we were there, my husband was injured, and we came home, and I began to teach again, this time at Firebrick, and we did some farming and, of course, canning, and we had started to raise some cattle, and the general kind of farming that we did, that everybody else did in that particular area. It was not a concentrated effort on one particular crop, but things that we could have for our own use and make a little money and store some for future use. After 2 or 3 years there at Firebrick, we bought a farm on Scaffolick, which was in the St. Paul community, and I began to teach at St. Paul. And I taught there probably 5 years, and my husband went to work at the A plant out at Piketon, Ohio, and we moved to Waverly, where I got a job teaching in the Waverly East Elementary School, a lovely new school with all the finest facilities. I've never taught yet in a building that was so up to date. I stayed there 2 years, and of course my son graduated from high school there and started Moorhead to school. My daughter and I were at home, and my husband was transferred to West Virginia to work. Well, with the farm at St. Paul and everybody scattered around, it was like operating four homes, so we had to do something about that. So we moved all of our furniture back to the farm, and I got a job in Portsmouth. Now, there was no difficulty getting a job there. I had good credentials and good recommendations, and Mr. McKelvey hired me. And so I taught there then until my retirement, which took place this past spring. But in hurrying through the school years, I didn't mention very many particular incidents. I wanted to mention that when I began to teach, there were no free textbooks. And the people at Firebrick, the first year I taught, most of the children had books or were able to get them. And those who couldn't buy books had friends who shared with them, and it worked out real well. But when I went to Montgomery to teach, I had nothing there to rely on. There were very few books and very few supplies. And we had Mr. Glass, who was an insurance man for Western Southern Insurance Company, and he worked our debit. And he was so kind and so generous with materials. I recall he brought little booklets once that contained the alphabet, and each letter was accompanied by a verse. We used the books for not only reading, but science and health and writing classes, and we learned to spell the words, and we made games out of these verses, and it was just really very, very good. Now, here's an example so that you can see how we could use these so extensively. A is for air that we breathe day and night. It must always be fresh to make us feel right. Then B is for bathing each day in a tub, followed up once by a brisk body rub. C is for cough. It's a cousin to sneeze. Cover them both with your handkerchief, please. And I could go on and on. There were 26 of them, of course, one for each letter. But this gives you an idea of how I could take the four-line stanza and make a reading lesson and all these other things I've mentioned. Then the children really did learn, and it was a good experience for me. Now, Mr. Glass also brought us old business letters that they were finished with, or envelopes that they no longer needed or used, and all sorts of things of that nature that we could put to very good use in our school. The Western Southern people also furnished me with a supply of song books, and these books contain patriotic songs. Now, I'm no songbird, I'll tell you, but we sure had fun and relaxation trying to make a joyful noise. Every year, I would have some person who could lead the singing, and, you know, had a good voice. And I remember on Montgomery, Marie Bentley was she was the older sister of the little Myrtle I told you the story about a few minutes ago. But Marie would lead the singing. And when we went to Spy Run, I had somebody else there. Lillian Irvin. I couldn't think for a minute what her name was. And then when I went to Rose Creek, there was still another person there. And then when I came back to Firebrick, you know, had a lot of people at Firebrick who were very, very good singers and who were not timid. Now everybody there either went to the Methodist Church or the Baptist Church, and they did a lot of singing, and nobody was a bit bashful, because that was just something that they felt was God-given talent, and they exercised it, whether it was at school or at church or wherever, and we did a lot of singing. Another place that we got free materials was from the Arm & Hammer Baking Soda Company. They usually sent a series of cards showing pictures of United States native birds on one side, and the story of the birds were on the reverse side. The Apanatupe, I wanted to mention too what we did with those bird cards. We used them in much the same way with the older children as I used the alphabet books with the younger children. We used them for reading and spelling and a little language lesson, some artwork, and all sorts of good things. Really, it's good to know, to see what all you can do with something that somebody else just might throw away. Now, the Apana Toothpaste Company sent toothbrushes, literature, and samples of toothpaste for each child. Now, the way they did this, they would get a list of teachers and their schools and addresses from the superintendent during the summer months. And then, by the time school started, we would have received a card from them asking the number of students we anticipated and all that, and we would mail it back to the Apana people, and by the time school opened, we'd have supplies, and it was a good learning experience. And many of the children didn't regularly brush their teeth, and they weren't taught the values of this in all the homes. Now, of course, some of them, but some they were not, and we did demonstrations, and we'd always take time at lunchtime to brush our teeth, and of course we'd wash our hands. Lifebuoy soap people were very good about sending out the health charts and sample bars of Lifebuoy soap. There again, we had a pump in the yard, and we'd go out and take turns pumping and holding our hands under the spout and washing our hands, and then maybe we'd just sling our hands dry, or maybe we'd have an old cloth, each of us bring our own little old towel, or maybe a ripped up sheet or whatever. But anyway, we did wash our hands. Now there was 44 years of teaching experience there for me, and I think the biggest change in the schools, well, naturally, I guess that would have to be the consolidation of the rural schools being consolidated into one big school where everybody went together, and then the departmental work rather than self-contained classrooms, and the transportation. You know, of course, when I started teaching, and for almost 20 years, my students walked to school. But in later years, everybody rode the bus, and I notice now children that go less than a quarter of a mile ride the bus. Of course, it would be dangerous for them to walk on the highway,
And 40 years ago, we didn't have these problems of wondering if your child was going to be hurt, or wondering whether or not he was going to be kidnapped, or, I better take that back. I remember one time when I was teaching on Montgomery, a man came to my door and knocked, and I went to the door, and he said, "I want to see a particular child." I've forgotten the child's name, but little Charles Stamper said, "Mrs. Hannah, don't you let him talk to him." So, of course, I believed Charles, and I didn't let the child go to the door. But the man was so much larger than I, and he pushed past me and grabbed the little six-year-old boy and left with him. So I called that my kidnapping. Now, it was the child's natural father, but the mother and father were separated, and he was living in Portsmouth, Ohio, and the mother was living on Montgomery and sending her children to school to me. Now, I didn't know these circumstances, but Charles Stamper did, and he was trying to help me out as best he could. But I remember it did work out all right. They were very frightened there for 5 or 6 days. But when they did, when the officials did track the man down, of course the little boy was safe, and the mother and father were reconciled, and they went back together and raised their family. And I guess they've probably forgotten that incident if they're still living, but I know it certainly frightened me. In the first 20 or 22 years of my teaching, I had to be my own janitor. And I did my own planning. I worked out my daily schedule. Of course, oftentimes I carried my own kindling to school. And I recall during my first few years, I could hire a man or a boy to get me a cord of stove wood for my schoolroom for $1.50. Now, as years went along, of course, the price of that increased, and then a little later on, we changed to coal. For several years, we had the long, flat-topped stove, and we fed wood into the front of that. And during the cold weather, I'd make soup or some other hot dish on top of the stove for the children, and maybe just a cupful of hot soup, or sometimes it would just be potato soup. But that was good, and it was something warm inside their bodies rather than just a cold sandwich or whatever they carried in their little pail or paper bag to school. Later on, we got what we called a pot-bellied stove, and we had coal for that. And by the time we got that kind of a stove and were accustomed to having the coal, and we didn't have the flat top stove to cook on anymore, we did have neighborhood stores, and usually they'd have something there that the child could get that was warm. But, I guess it must have been in 1949 that I went to St. Paul to teach, and we had a lunch program there. Now, Ethel Bevins did the cooking, and that was done in a converted cloakroom. Now, in at St. Paul School, there was two buildings, one on either side of the railroad track, and Mrs. Stamper had the little children up to the third or fourth grade, and she converted that cloakroom to a kitchen, and she hired Ethel, or the school board hired Ethel to cook there. And I took my students across the railroad at lunchtime, where we would get the hot lunch. Now, oftentimes we would get over there and a train would come along and stop, and we'd have a ball game for the afternoon, you know, because there was not a law at that time saying, okay, train, you have to move in 30 minutes or whatever, like there is today. And they would sit there until whatever was wrong got fixed, or the other train got out of their way. And there was not much to do except have a ball game. And we'd play ball over near Mrs. Stamper's school building. And when the train moved so that we'd go back to our building and we'd work again. Or if it was time for the bus, we'd go home. Then you see, those buildings are not there anymore. In fact, there are no one-room schools in Lewis County. The St. Paul children and Firebrick children and the ones from Montgomery and Spiron and all those places that I've named you, except Rose, are transported to Garrison. Now, the Rose children are transported to Laurel, I believe. I think that would be the consolidated school they'd go to. And the high school children are brought all the way to Vanceburg, which there's just two high schools in Lewis County. One is at Tollsboro, and the other one is at Vanceburg. So children do travel a long ways today, and I feel sorry for them, because that's tiring to travel 20 miles or 25 miles or even further to do a day's work in the classroom and then travel back. I can hardly help but believe that they were better off in the smaller schools in their own neighborhood. Of course, I can be wrong, you know. I wanted to say something more about the Waverly school system. Now, that new building was built due to the influx of people with the A plant, but I guess it became overcrowded after I left there, and other new buildings have been put up. But when I was at Waverly, I no longer had a self-contained classroom or several classes to teach. I just taught 7th grade science, math, and geography. Now, the children didn't move from room to room. The teacher carried her supplies and went from her own room to whatever room she had to see a class in. So I spent a third of my time in each of three different rooms. My daughter did her second grade and third grade work in Waverly, and then we moved back to St. Paul, and I taught in the Roosevelt School at Portsmouth. Then I taught afternoons at Wilson School. At that time, the principals taught mornings, taught half day, and the other teacher taught the other half day. Now, the morning Miss Virginia Stewart was in her office, and I taught her classes. In the afternoon, she took her classes, and I went over to Wilson School and taught Mr. Brooker's regular classes. Now, of course, I was teaching math and literature. One of the fellas didn't like to teach art at Roosevelt, so I took his art classes, and he took my physical education classes, so that worked out real well. From The following year, then, I went to Roosevelt for full time in sixth grade, and I had a self-contained classroom there. I started out with 26 students and wound up the year with 26. They were all smart children, very, very intelligent, and were given a lot of encouragement at home. In fact, I think maybe had they not done their best work, they would have been punished at home, or there would at least been things brought to bear on them to make them know that it was very important that they did do their own very best work. Now, during my time of talking, I skipped a little thing there. I did teach 10 weeks at South Portsmouth School after my school at St. Paul had closed. Now, I'm not sure I enjoyed that as much as I might have enjoyed it. I worked with good people and I enjoyed the ladies I taught with, particularly because they were girls that I had gone to school with, and two of the girls, Opal and Jewel Stevenson, I'd roomed with in college. And Mr. Raymond Brooker was the principal, and he's a fine, fine school man and knew just what he was doing. But I had to teach high school classes, and I was not trained for that. My training was all in the elementary field, and of course, when you're out of your element, I think you feel you're not doing your very best work. Now, that was before I went to Waverly by probably 5 years. So I have told you about being in Waverly and being at Roosevelt and being at Wilson. And from there I went to Grant, and I taught all of the 8th grade math classes from the time I went for about 19 years, I guess. Now, I had two different superintendents in Lewis County. That was Miss Anna L. Bertram that I mentioned early in this tape. She was an unmarried lady. She came to visit our schools once each month or more often, and she always brought her secretary with her. Miss Anna was always impeccably dressed. She made you feel important. You wanted to dress the best you could. The students and the teacher wanted to be well-dressed because we never knew when Miss Anna was coming. Now, none of us had the very best of clothing, but we did keep ourselves clean and neat, and we always had our hair combed and looked the best we could, and we tried to do our best work when Miss Anna came. And of course, she always wanted either a spelling contest or a math contest, or she wanted to hear a couple of classes taught, and then she'd play a game or two with us. And she made us feel important and feel that we were doing a good job. Then we had Mr. Thomas Rowland, who was he had been an English teacher at the high school in Lewis County, and there again we had a very efficient fella in the office, and he came to visit us, but he usually brought along a board member when he came, and he was of course, being English oriented, he wanted to hear an English class or a spelling class. And he would always check the writing to see if people wrote well. And again, he made a person feel important. I taught for Mr. Brooker the 10 weeks at South Portsmouth. And I taught for Mr. Charles... somebody or other, forgotten his name, at Waverly. Then there was Mr. McKelvey was superintendent in Portsmouth, and from Mr. McKelvey, I believe we went to, we had somebody between Mr. McKelvey and Mr. Fannin, but Mr. Didway and then Mr. Fannin, and we had good principals at all the schools. And then, of course, I retired on June the 5th, 1978, and since my little light's blinking, maybe I'll have to change tapes. But anyway, I did teach 44 years, and I believe it was successful teaching. Oftentimes, the pay was poor. I know I started teaching for $57 a month, and but I made a lot of friends, and I still have very good friends who were my students, and many of my former students are professional people, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, teachers, and the like, and very few did not turn out well, but I did enjoy, and I do love my students, and maybe sometime I might go back to teaching, I don't know, but I have had the 44, I feel, successful years, and I hope somebody will sometime get some enjoyment out of this tape and maybe get some information that they about things that they have not known about, and that it will be of help to whoever might listen. I could have told you many, many little funny stories about things that had happened in school, and maybe I'll make another tape. I don't know. I had so many things to tell about my mother, about her recipes and games that she played with us, because really she was my inspiration, and she was the person who inspired me to become a teacher. And actually, my mother was a fine, fine person and a very good psychologist. Everything she did had a purpose with us children, and she made us feel our worth.